You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
What's up, Wisecrack? Welcome to Show Me the Meaning, Wisecrack's movie podcast. My name's Michael.
Show me the meaning!
Oh, I fucked up already. I'm so sorry. That was a great Show Me the Meaning. That'll be the last mistake. My name's Michael. I am here with Ryan and
what up, film fans?
And Austin.
Yo.
And today we're going to discuss the 2019 film Uncut Gems by the Safdie brothers, starring your favorite comedic actor, Adam Sandler, in a decidedly non-comedic role. Mm-hmm. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My favorite actor is Kevin Garnett. I don't know what you're talking about.
Yes, of course. The only Oscar nominee from this film will be Kevin Garnett and or one of the creepy bald guys asking for money. But before we really get into this, what were y'all's impressions of the film?
Ryan, jump in there.
Okay, well, I'll start this off. So I'll start it off by saying I could not have been more excited for this movie. To me, the Safdie brothers are like probably the most interesting filmmakers around today. I just love what they're doing. They just got it going on, man. They know how to make a tone, how to make momentum, how to entertain an audience with light, sound, and pictures and music. So I think that they're the real deal. They're great. And so anyway, I do think this movie is kind of this movie and Parasite are similar in the sense that they've been hyped up a lot for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. I feel like a lot of people go into these movies thinking, oh man, I'm about to see something insane. And they are. However, I think that both of them, I feel like are that amount of hype kind of allows for some people to kind of be let down at the end of the movie. I think that if you go into this movie thinking that you're seeing this amazing Adam Sandler movie, that I feel like some people might have been disappointed. I was definitely shaken by the ending, which I'm sure we'll go into in detail. But so basically, my thoughts of the movie was that I was super on board with it. I was really loving the ride I was on, and then it ends in the end, and you guys know what I'm talking about, and I definitely was shook. Like,
yeah.
I'm like, my initial reaction.
We can say we're all spoilers all the time on this show, right?
So sure. Yeah, spoilers. I just wasn't going to spoil it so early, but yes, at the when the part when Adam Sandler gets shot in the face,
right in the face.
My initial reaction was, hey, what is the point of this movie? What did I just sit through for an hour and a half? Why was I on this ride for the end so abruptly? That's, you know, and then the more I've thought about it, the more time has gone by. And I do definitely think that's obviously by design, and which we'll get into, but I love it. I do think it's an intellectual way to end your movie, not necessarily the most emotional way, but in a way that's cool. They're definitely trolling you in a way. And it does a very interesting thing at that moment where you're kind of like, you think you're seeing one thing, and then you're like, oh, this movie's just about, you know, the randomness and chaos of life and the, you know, how, yeah, of course this guy's story would end this way by just pissing off the wrong guy in Brooklyn and then him blowing your head off because of his ego. That makes sense for the context of what we've seen. You're not going to get the Hollywood storybook ending, which it seems like, you know, you're kind of getting, you know, with the montage of her taking the money to Vegas.
Yeah.
So anyway, I do think that they did something very interesting with that end. Obviously it doesn't work for everybody, but I thought the movie was great. And then I also overall I'd give it 8.5 to 9 out of 10. You know, it did not meet my sky high good time expectations. It's no fucking good time. Their Ooh. Last movie that was like brilliant. Amazing and my favorite movie of 2017. You know, I don't think it delivers on that promise, but it was great. And I can't wait to talk about it.
Awesome, Ryan. There's so many great things that you brought up that I'm excited for us to break down later. Austin, first impressions of Uncut Gems. Go.
Yeah, totally. I think, again, it's not as good as Good Time, but that's because I think Good Time is a genuine masterpiece. And I know we use that word, but it is in like the pantheon of masterpieces of the last few years, I think, right? But this film, I still think, is fucking excellent. I went in with very few expectations. So for people who don't know, we have a writer's room for Wisecrack where a bunch of people like talk shit and they share ideas and bounce ideas off each other. And this film was mentioned just in the sense of just being praised a couple times, right? Like, mm-hmm. So I knew that everyone in the writer's room, who I all respect, had high opinions on this film. And then one of our producers, Joy, she reached out to me and was like, what did you think of it? What did you think of it? And so I was like, okay, if it's eliciting this much excitement, there must be something worthwhile here. So I went in with a little bit of like emotional expectation, at least that I was kind of excited for it. But I didn't know content. I didn't know twist. I didn't know anything at the level of narrative. And I was fucked up after this film, man. I couldn't sleep. It had me inside, like twisted in knots. And then... you know, there's no catharsis at the end, and it was really provocative. And I thought that I actually think there's like a really interesting moral or ethical quandary that is brought up by that. I thought that there were some really amazing performances. I tweeted out my takeaways were Kevin Garnett can act, like, holy shit. I was so surprised at that because usually athletes, I mean, like LeBron did all right in some of the film stuff that he's done, but usually athletes are not actors, right? I mean, it's a very different thing. He was fucking great in it. Like, he like understood
so good
pacing and beats in the moment. So I was really impressed with that. Julia Fox,
he had a lot of dialogue.
Like, it wasn't just like cheap acting either. It was like he actually was a contributor, a big time contributor to a lot of scenes. Julia Fox is, first of all, I'm in love with her, but second of all, she's gonna be a star. This is her first fucking movie role. She's going to be a star. Marvel is calling. It's gonna happen. And then the
isn't she just like a socialite from New York that they found on Instagram?
Well, I know she's a socialite.
No, she's an artist. She worked artist.
Dominic.
Sure, that's what that's what she calls herself.
No, I've seen some of her installations. Actually,
I'm just kidding.
I know. No, but really, I've seen interviews with her of some of her installations. She's pretty fucking cool. And she's known them for like 7 years, I guess. So they've been talking about this film for years and years and years. So it's not like some new search where they just found a girl with some cakes, which. Yeah. But beyond that, she's fucking amazing, dude. Like, for someone who's never done anything before, like, I couldn't, the scene with her and Sandler when they're crying. Okay. So she's going to be a star. And then my last takeaway is just the Safdie brothers just fucking get tension. So that was it. Oh, and Adam Sandler. I mean, I've always said this. I think comedic actors who understand improvisation, their best roles are when they're doing serious stuff because they get tone, they get pacing, they get moments, they get beats, they don't force anything. Fucking brilliant. So that's my takeaway. I love the movie. It fucked me up, tied me up in knots, and I couldn't sleep last night.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pie, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Wow, this is so boring because I agree on most things that y'all said. Really loved it. I do, to piggyback on Ryan's point, it was an issue of there was so much expectation going into it. I sat down in a theater just so jacked up, kind of expecting to love it. And I did, but the biggest takeaway I had was almost emotional. I can't remember a movie I've seen where I was truly on the edge of my seat the whole time. There was a young woman sitting next to me who kept covering her face throughout the film. And I was thinking, like, I'm right there with you. And then towards the end of the movie at the pivotal shooting scene, Afterwards, I said to my partner, like, that's crazy. You know, everyone just screamed at the end there. And she was like, no, that was just you. Cause I just screamed, oh shit, as loud as I ever have in a theater when he gets popped in the face. And we'll break that down more a little bit later. But yeah, it was sort of a masterwork of building tension throughout. And I think that tension did something really interesting as an audience member. I really felt like I was a part of something happening there. And I even noticed in the theater, people kind of looking around at each other as if like, we're all in this together. This is crazy. What's going to happen? And the Safdie brothers' ability to do that with a film is pretty impressive.
So impressive. Yeah.
So I'm excited to hear what you guys have to think about this. But let's first do a quick recap for any listener who hasn't seen it yet. If you haven't, you should. We'll run through this and we're going to get in some of the big ideas. So without any further ado, our movie starts at a diamond mine in Ethiopia, but quickly transitions to the end of a colonoscopy taking place in New York City in the spring of 2012, where we see the colon of the film's protagonist, Howard, played by Adam Sandler. Now, our guy is a jeweler in New York City's Diamond District, and when we enter his shop for the first time, he immediately tries to offer a water to some goons and gets bitch slapped because they are here to collect money for a loan shark named Arno. They take $12,000 and a watch from him right off the bat. Now, he leaves there, flips a necklace to put money on a bet with a bookie played by iconic New York City radio personality Mike Francesa, heads back to his shop and is greeted by NBA player Kevin Garnett, playing himself, and also is greeted by a box of fish that he's used to smuggle an Ethiopian opal into the country. Now, Howard shows this to KG, and KG needs it, so he lets him, quote-unquote, hold it for a night, and gives Howard his Celtics championship ring for collateral. Howard, being an honest guy, of course, immediately pawns it, takes the money, and puts more money on a bet with his bookie on KG and the Celtics. He wins huge and celebrates with one of the weirdest sexting-based closet hiding scenes I've ever seen. Nothing like that has ever happened in real life, but I'm glad it's in a film. Next day, he wants this opal back, but his assistant, Damani, played by Lakeith Stanfield, with terrifying brilliance, shows up without the opal. They go on a rescue mission to Philadelphia. He gets abandoned, and that doesn't work out. Gets back. This is Howard again. Finally gets back to Long Island via bus to see his daughters play, just in time to get jumped, stripped naked, and left in his trunk by Arno the loan shark and his goons, who we find out canceled his bet before he won. Things not looking good for Howard. He then heads to a club where he finds his mistress and coworker Julia, maybe or maybe not banging the weekend, also playing himself in a bathroom, and kicks her to the curb. He finally gets the opal back from KG, Kevin Garnett, and celebrates at a joyous Passover dinner with his family, which it turns out includes the loan shark Arno, who is his brother-in-law. He brags about the opal in the coming auction in front of his family and convinces his father-in-law to come along. Cut to the auction where things get much worse. They reappraise his opal. It's worth a fraction of what he's assumed, and he has to get his father-in-law, Gooey, to jack up the price so KG will buy it, but he doesn't. And after he gets knocked in the throat and tossed into a fountain by the goon squad. Finally, it seems like things are going well. Kevin Garnett comes through, buys the opal, gives Howard enough money to pay off Arno and clear his debts, thus leading to a happy ending. God. But after talking to KG about how he's the Diamond District equivalent of an NBA player, he instead takes all the money, passes it through a window to Julia, and has her helicopter to a casino to put it all on KG and the Celtics, leading to the tense conclusion of the film where Arno and the goons show up, how he traps them in his bulletproof glass-covered entryway as he watches the game, and somehow it all works out. His bet wings big, and Julia uses a silver-haired friend to get the money, but the second he opens the doors, Howie gets shot in the head. Soon to be followed by Arno. He's dead. The end. The camera goes into the wound. Whew. So that's the
Holy
movie.
Shit. What
that's
a
the movie.
Movie.
I know, and we're going to talk about it.
What a recap.
But first, we quickly got to thank our sponsors who are making this possible. Today's show, sponsored by Skillshare. Now, I don't know about you guys. Do you guys have 2020 resolutions?
I got one or two.
Okay, well,
yeah, I got a couple.
Okay, well, maybe get to them. But for right now, I'm going to talk about myself and say I'm trying to make 2020 a year where I learn some new things and really focus on some of my existing creative passions. And this is why I think Skillshare is awesome. It's an online learning community where millions of curious minds come together to continue on their own creative journeys. They have thousands of classes with topics ranging from graphic design to photography to web development to crafts. And because I'm really trying to work on upping my writing practice in 2020, I'm checking out the course. My guy, I'm checking out this course, Creative Writing for All, a 10-day journaling challenge, which is taught by Emily Gould. I'm a writer I've liked for years, so I was so excited to see her teaching a course. And it's a course that gives you some simple practices to write a little bit every day. And at the end of the course, she showed you how to put it all into a piece of writing. It's awesome. I'm excited to check out more courses. Now, one of the best parts about Skillshare is how affordable it is compared to taking a class in person, especially. The annual subscription is less than $10 a month. That's pretty cheap. And you can get 2 months of free premium membership right now by going to Skillshare.com/wisecrack. So why not learn something new in 2020? It makes way more sense than that gym membership that you'll use 3 times and they'll keep charging your card and you can't get out of the membership. So go to Skillshare.com/wisecrack today and start your free 2 month premium membership. Now, we are also sponsored today by another awesome place called Likewise. Now, I don't know about our listeners, but if you ever find yourself endlessly scrolling through your streaming service or Spotify or a podcast app.
Yeah, right.
And we're like, what do I watch? What do I watch? There's so much out there. It's overload. Well, this is where Likewise comes in. It's an app that helps you discover what to watch or read next. It works across all the streaming services you already use. And once you set it up, you'll not only be able to get recommendations from your friends and family, which is so much fun, but you'll also have access to recommendations and lists offered by Likewise. You can even use it to recommend, I don't know, Show Me the Meaning. So I'm saying, why not? Why not, right? You get on there, you recommend it. Everyone sees that you like it. They like it. Everyone wins. And you can download Likewise today on the App Store or the Google Play Store by going to likewise.com/meaning. Likewise.com/meaning. It's an amazing way to find fresh new content and culture to consume as we head into 2020, and it'll help you avoid searching through Netflix for an hour only to be too tired to watch a movie by the time you pick something. So, likewise.com/meaning. God, we've been there. But now let's get back to Uncut Gems. Fellas.
One thing I didn't say in my initial things is we didn't really talk about the form yet. I don't know if you're about to talk about the form, but I love how this is like a Cassavetes-esque Robert Altman. Like you talked about it being, you know, building tension. I've never seen a movie that built tension, but using a really naturalistic aesthetic. Yeah,
kind of like the post-dogma style.
The thriller version of, you know, of a woman under the influence or something. Mm. It's a character study. You're following them, but it's like they build that tension.
And I think that's such a great point. I think, did I hear you start saying the word Bourne in reference to the Bourne films?
It's not really like it as much of an epic action movie as that, but it's like,
but there's
that,
something similar know. About the way you feel, especially in the first Bourne movie. You're on the edge of your seat, the camera's shaking, we're falling, we don't know what's going to happen, and there the stakes seem a bit higher because people are dying left and right. But God, if this film doesn't make you feel that same tension as we worry about one guy's basketball bets.
It's
more like the green grass Bourne. Yeah, sorry.
Absolutely. And I wonder if something else that gets tied into that is the mixing, the sound levels. Now, I watched this at home, but I bet if you watched it in a theater, it would have been even more jarring because the mix level is totally out of whack from what we would normally expect. The music levels are really high, right? And they're not subtle. They're pushed into the forefront. And not only are they cool and kind of retro in their aesthetic, and there's even like almost like the Nintendo text that comes up that circles the title screen for Uncut Gems, you know, the little oval that goes around it. So there's like a retro thing as well with the style of music, the kind of synthy music, but also the levels just really create this tension in me, they created this tension in me because it made me uncomfortable with how loud the music was and then how loud the street sounds were and how loud.
I listened to an interview with the Safdie brothers, and they actually talked about how, when they did the ADR, so the audio that you record and add after you do all the primary filming, normally you go in and they said it's like average to maybe have like 8 pages of stuff to record. Yeah. And I guess it was like almost a full other script of all the background audio. Yeah. And I guess the audio editing for the film, I don't know about audio editing, but supposedly was just like the most intricate job ever. Because as we know, when you watch this film, there's constant layers of talking. And even from that first scene, when Howie goes into the jewelry shop, we literally hear 4 to 5 conversations happening over each other in a constant clip. So not only does it affect you, but the editing and the audio to go into that is so impressive.
And also, it's really easy to understand, surprisingly, with as much overlapping dialogue. I mean, I was picking up on almost everything they were saying, and it all added to it. Are y'all familiar with Altman stuff? Have you guys seen Nashville or MASH or any of his ones that really feature the overlapping dialogue? That's definitely what I was feeling during this movie, where it was like, yeah, this is like a scene straight out of Nashville, but like set up in urban New York. You know,
it's like a much more polished thing than what the mumblecore genre people were trying to do, you know, which I love. I love the mumblecore films. I love that style. I love that aesthetic.
Mumblecore really wasn't about, though, like the naturalism. It was just about, like, you know, how cheap and easy filmmaking with, you know, in based on relationships and kind of, it was more about the themes, I would say, and the format rather than we're trying to really replicate life and put you right there, you know?
Yeah. Like, and
can't
I know
really do that with a DV camera.
I love how we're talking about Uncut Gems. And if you would have asked me, what might we talk about? Mumblecore films would have been the bottom of my list. So I love this. Shouts to the Duplass brothers.
So the thing that's interesting though is with this element, like there's an intentional chaos that the Safdie brothers are trying to say about just the world, maybe. You know,
see,
I mean, maybe,
I'm going to jump in on this because that's the question I was just about to ask you guys. That's brilliant. Yeah. But no, I think you're absolutely right, Austin. I was going to ask both of you, like, the audio chaos, I think, is like indicative of the more, I guess we'd call it relational or structural chaos we see throughout the film. So I'd love to hear what both of y'all think about the theme of chaos in the film, how it's used, and maybe what you think that could be getting at.
Yeah. Well, let me just jump in here and I think there's something really interesting that we can tie together with chaos in relation to violence. So like I was thinking a lot about like Scorsese films and like typical mob films, which you get these guys from New York that are hassling Adam Sandler's character Howard. And in my mind, I'm thinking the whole time they're going to fucking kill him. They're going to use their violence to kill him. And they don't. There's this restrained violence. Like, yeah, they beat him up a little bit, but they don't ever pull out a gun until the very end. Right. And I was thinking, like, why don't they do that? Like, when they kidnap him at his kid's play, I'm thinking, oh, fuck, they took him in a van. They're going to cut his dick off or something like that. They're going to do, you know, but they don't.
They want their money.
Yeah, they just want their money. They don't want to kill him. And then so they're constantly, like, pushing up against, like, what we would think of as the typical mob violence kind of stuff that you see in the Scorsese films where it's like everybody's just fucking killing everybody all the time. But the Safdies don't paint that world. They paint a different kind of world. And it's like just this world of constant chaos and confusion. And there's like rules to it. Cause like even the people in the Diamond District are like, no, 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 whoa, whoa. Like don't beat anybody up. And then when he comes in with the black eyes, people are like really concerned. Like, cause that's abnormal to be physically abused. This is just gambling. It's business. It's dealing. You know, we don't cross that other line, which I think is what makes the violence at the end so unjust. Like that's how it feels, right? Because we're like,
I mean, do you think that with what they're doing in the Diamond District, with sort of like the laws that regulate that violence, I couldn't help but thinking about how the Safdie brothers are focusing on this one part of New York, the Diamond District, where a bunch of people are hustling and scamming to try to make money.
Right.
When however many, you know, blocks away, I don't know New York well, sorry. We have Wall Street, where people in fancier buildings with nicer suits are doing things that are pretty similar in terms of scamming, hustling, trying to get on top of things. So, I mean, and I know, Austin, you might have something to say about this because you're a man of finance and economics. Do you think there's any sort of connection there between like contemporary finance capitalism and the way in which this is a microcosm of larger systems at play?
1,000%. I just want to say something real quick and then I'll kick it over to Ryan. There's a book written by a guy named Ole Bjerg, who is a scholar in a business school in Copenhagen, but he does a lot of work on finance and gambling. So his first book is on poker, and then his next book is on money. It's called Making Money, I think. And then his most recent book is on like growth and finance capital, or actually what he calls the post-growth world. But he looks at gambling and the kind of the compulsive drive that gamblers Spencer's exhibit and how that relates to contemporary neoliberal financial capitalism, and that we live in a world of just like creation for the sake of creation's sake, which is kind of similar to the gambler's compulsion, which I think fits into why we feel why the Safdies can't give us a happy ending at the end. Because if they do that, then they kind of like tie a nice neat bow on what is otherwise just this pure world of drive that doesn't have goals or anything. And he wasn't going to be happy if he got that money. You know, he'd just repeat the same patterns because he's compulsive. He's pathological. So I think absolutely this is a larger, it's like an aperture into a larger economic tendency.
Yeah, I was going to basically say similar things that, you know, this movie's first and foremost about a degenerate gambler. And they're addicted to risk. And, you know, it's funny you brought up the Wall Street thing because, yeah, like I don't think it's explicitly said, you know, made the comparisons made. But, yeah, those people are that is what they make their money in, is risk assessment and putting money where their mouth is, you know, and saying let's let it ride and whatever. And that whole mentality, which I actually, you know, when I was watching the movie too, I don't know about you guys, but I was a little confused because they didn't at first, because they weren't really specifying the stakes. You don't really know the exact amount of money he always is in need of. Whereas a normal Hollywood movie would tell you, oh, I need this amount of money to save the car wash or whatever the fuck. But like this movie is like, yeah, he just owes money in general. And I think that definitely was by design, like that they're not specifying it, because I mean, it is just, he's addicted to just putting it out there. Like, you know, for one, like, I don't think in the movie, he has a fucking penthouse. He has a nice family and a nice home and all, you know, it seems like he has money, but it seems like he's definitely risking enough to where these bad guys are after him, to where it's important, but he never seems to care like a normal person would. Right. He doesn't reach these decisions like a normal person, where, you know, there's like two or three times in the movie where, like you said, you put your hands in your face. You're like, what the fuck? Mm-hmm. Why are you doing this? You have it all, you know, or you don't need to do this, but he's addicted to it. And so getting back, going back to the sound design and stuff, that I think that that's what they're trying to put you in the world of, is just the chaos of degenerate gamblers. Like their life is just, you know, a mile a minute, and you know, you're always trying to come up with your next scheme to band-aid the last scheme that you fucked up. Right. And
well, he's trying to spread his risk, right? He's trying to mitigate uncertainty through risk management. So he's paying these people with these people's money and then paying it here. And he's not ever deleveraging, right? He's not ever actually eradicating his debt, is what we would say. He's using his leverage to spread his risk so that it's not concentrated in a single point. Or in other words, he's diversifying his portfolio.
Yeah,
right. Like, right. But then he wins out, and he doesn't need to make another bet, but he still does it. Why? Why does he?
Because he's
that?
An addict. You know? And that's something that's interesting too. Is like with addiction in film, there's so many examples of like alcohol or drug addiction being explored in film. It's pretty rare to have gambling as the addiction that's at the center of a film. I mean, there's some examples, but
the gambler with Khan. Well,
what's that movie with Ben? With
Rounders?
I
love Rounders.
Mississippi Grind. Is that what it was called?
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's a really good movie on this. Yeah. But yeah, you're right. You're right.
But it's like a more foreign type of addiction, because I think, not to be too dark, but like everyone's known a drunk or a drug addict in their life. I'm sorry that you've had to, but we've all known that. I feel like, I don't know, I've never known a gambling addict, or at least that I saw it outwardly.
Oh, I know several, and I love gambling personally. I'm definitely in this world. But I definitely can relate, and I see this guy. I see Adam Sandler. Character in some friends of mine.
I am a gambling addict, and I have had to cut myself off from it. For me, my weakness was poker. From when I was 17 till probably even within the last few years. I mean, I'd say within the last 5 years, I've kind of been able to get it under control, where I don't even go to the casino anymore. But congrats. I used to go all the time. Bro, when we were in Scotland, like, I don't know if it was when we were
I was going to say, listeners might not know this, but about a decade ago, so when we were, 14 and 16, respectively, Austin and myself were roommates in Scotland, and I remember a few nights where I heard the door open really late or really early. Or
mornings,
Yeah, thought to myself, bars aren't open that late, and then heard, like, oh, I was at the casino.
Yeah, it was
as an average grad student does.
I did have a compulsion to the game of poker. And for me, it was never sports betting. I didn't really get into blackjack and shit like that. It was the game of poker. And I can...
Yeah, it's so fun.
Yes. And I get it. Like, it wasn't even about... Like, you feel a rush even when you lose, right? Like, there's something about it because it continually, like, pulls you back into the game because you can get the game better. It's about mastering the game. And you become this player. And I think that fits into what's going on here is that's why when Sandler makes that comparison to Garnett about him, this is his NBA, right? He's not a professional basketball player. This is his game that he plays, that he's a master of. And I think that for me is really interesting because he's lying to himself in one sense. He thinks that he's a master. He thinks he's in control of it. But then we realize that I think that actually it's in control of him, or it's this dynamic tension between the two.
Yeah, I wonder if that gambling theme doesn't touch on at all this kind of the theme of like hustle culture that people talk about. Because while other characters in the film aren't gambling, you know, the Lakeith Stanfield character is on his hustle, getting clients, hiding his fake watches. Julia is clearly out here in clubs doing whatever she's doing at the weekend to try to get clients as well. And this idea, you know, you'll see like a shirt at your local SoulCycle class or something that's like bet on yourself. I don't know if that exists, but there's that kind of logic of like hustle, bet on yourself. Take risk, like work hard. And in a weird way, it was like Sandler's character is just the like extreme other side of that line. But most people in the film were engaging in some type of behavior like that.
So like everybody in the film was compulsive in their own way or pathological in their own way.
Well, I mean, and maybe that's like a New York thing or a commentary on what it's like to try to get money in contemporary society. Yeah. But it seemed like that was another underlying theme of like everyone is trying to get it however they can get it.
Let me ask you this. This is going to sound like a weird thing, but I wanted to ask both of you because a film that popped into my mind as I was watching this was The Killing, Stanley Kubrick's The Killing. And they're different but similar in these senses. So The Killing is all about this heist, right? This crew of people that are trying to knock off, what is it? It was a racetrack. And they get away with it at the end, but then because of the Hays Code at the time that the film was made, you couldn't show bad guys getting away with crimes. So what happens? The bag at the airport gets knocked over and all the money gets blown away in the wind, right? And that's viewed as like like a justice against the criminal because you can't show the bad guys getting away with a crime. Now, something similar is going on here. We're rooting for Sandler to get out of this cycle, just like we're rooting for the gamblers or for the criminals, I guess, the crooks to get away with the heist and the killing. But it's different because this is framed through like psychological addiction. And so the reason that we can't let Sandler get away or you can't let Howard get away with it is because that would almost like justify his addiction, or it almost like makes it good or something like that. So it's like, you can't expose Howard to more self-harm. So it's almost like it's still got like a, there's something going on here, but we feel unjust about it still, right? Like we wanted Sandler to win, just like you want the criminals to get away with it. We feel like it's not right, but they're making a statement by doing something kind of like, no, you can't have that cathartic ending, but it's different than it was, you know, in like the 50s or 60s, whenever, I think it's the 50s when The Killing is made.
It's oddly beautiful at the end too, because I think in our mind, like either he's going to win the bet and then pay them off, which I think in our head we're like, but how does that work out? That seems too clean. Yeah. Or as I think we expect, he's going to lose the bet and he's fucked, but he wins the bet and gets shot in the face immediately. So it's like both sides getting mixed. And I think that's the jarring part about it. I did wonder, well, and Ryan, you brought this up before. Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to add, you know, I've seen some people say like that, or justify that moment, like he won the bet, like he was on top of the world and he went out on top.
Yeah.
In a weird way, even though it was with a bullet through his mind, his fucking brain.
Is it almost a gracious act? Like it puts him out of his misery?
I don't know.
No, well, it's not a gracious act by that guy that was just trying to, you know, was just
no, I mean by the Safdies. Well, but maybe it is by them. Because he's fucking miserable, and the only time you see him really come to grips with who he actually is in his addiction is when he's in the office after he gets beat up with Julia when they make up, and he's bawling about everything's a mess, I'm a loser, I can't win, I can't get on top of things. he's fucking miserable, even though we don't see his misery. We just see him constantly doing to manage and manage and manage and then repress his actual having to actually face the fact that he's fucking miserable by playing this game. So is there a sense in which almost like he's euthanized?
But the guy, it was a pure act of aggression by that dude who's an awesome actor.
A fucking great actor, yeah.
It reminds me of, like, you know, you have that creepy uncle that tells you that that he wants to die in the middle of committing a coital act to someone who's not your aunt. And then you got to process a few things there. But his point, of course, is like, I want to go out on top. Someone else that's not your aunt. I don't know. None of my uncles talk like that. I'm not from Jersey. But I wonder, so this is also related to the conclusion of the film. And I think both of you referenced this at the top. Do we get any moral message, or is there kind of an ethic at the end of this film, or is it just bleak meaninglessness? What do y'all think's going on there?
Yeah. Rye.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's don't be a degenerate gambler. This is what it'll lead to is one of it. I mean, I the question I was going to pose to you guys is, what do you guys think the Safdies feel about this guy? I mean, I've seen a few interviews. I mean, they don't think he's a loser, but like, do you guys think that, I mean, I guess this is tied into your question about, I mean, they chose to kill this guy in this manner, in this very abrupt, jarring way in their movie, you know, that they had built all this tension up for. This is a very, you know, bold decision that they made. And yeah, I don't know. I'm conflicted on what I think that they mean by it. I do think it is something, you know, the whole movie just being so naturalistic to begin with, I do think it is about just the chaotic, you know, nature, and you're fucked, you know, you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. But I mean, yeah, I don't know. What do you guys think?
Well, I think we root for Sandler. We're rooting for him to win. We're rooting for him to find harmony, some kind of stability in the midst of the chaos. We're rooting for that, but we also pity him. And I think that the Safdie brothers might pity this man who is degenerate in the literal sense of the term, right? And so I wonder if the title of the film, Uncut Gems, doesn't speak to this, right? Like are humans uncut gems that were worlds of beauty? Because there's all these amazing moments of like transcendence and beauty in the mystical where we go into the stone, or at the very end, you go into the bullet hole, which is interesting. You go into the hole of violence, right? To go into Sandler, into this beauty. And then, of course, remember when the stone connects to his colon? So it's like there's something about...
when he says at one point, you know, they say you can see the whole universe when you look into this thing.
Yeah. So is there, Sartre has this amazing essay for people out there that I know Michael really loves on Kierkegaard called The Singular Universal. But the idea is that I'm going to oversimplify it, but that the universal is contained in the particular, in the singular. So you can look at a rock and the entire universe is there. Or for Sartre, the entire history of the world of manufacture is contained in this ballpoint pen that I'm holding. So we can look about...
That's like some medieval shit, dude.
Like steel production, you can understand... like minerals, you can understand plastic, which then leads you into like the fossil fuel industry and how you burn plastics, right? Like everything is contained in this pen. The history of writing, Shakespeare is contained in this singular ballpoint pen. If you just kind of attune yourself appropriately to the universal dimensions that are in there. And I was thinking a lot about that. And then I was thinking, so then like, are we uncut gems? You know, like there's this unpolished wildness, the drives, you know, that are exhibited or exemplified by his addiction to gambling, and then the mess that he kind of continues to put himself in. He's a miserable human. There's this uncutness about it. But at the same time, you know, that you can cut gems, you can modify them, you can fit them into society, you can... I mean, there's something going on here, and I thought that might have been part of the ethic.
Well,
that this
and even this makes me think of the beginning of the film, right? Because they do something really interesting. The opening scene, you know, the film opens in Ethiopia with someone that has a horrific leg injury at a diamond mine. And then we see two guys go back into the mine themselves to uncover what ends up being Howard Sandler's character's opal. So even the way in which in the Diamond District, it's all this flash and like Furby eyeballed necklaces and stuff, but all of that emerges from a real like dark place. There's a violence inherent in the production of this stuff, and I did like that the film dropped that in as a reminder, and I do think they did that in a self-aware way.
Well, and it's such an awesome way to start your movie, and it really like exactly what you just said. It recontextualizes the entire film. Like if you had just seen the whole movie without that opening scene, you know, it's different. Like whereas they're definitely playing with the whole like you said, everything's connected. One action leads to a butterfly effect reaction down the line. And, you know, it's all, like you said before, Austin, you know, the universe is in everything, you know, and whatever, we're all connected, blah, blah, blah. And I thought that was a really cool cinematic way to begin your movie.
And isn't it also, it comes like, back around, relevant?
Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead, brother.
I was going to say, even comes back around when KG says to Sandler, like, well, you know, how much did you pay these guys in Ethiopia? Yeah. And kind of implies like, oh, you don't have to pay them for it because they're just some Ethiopian guys. So even in that moment, like the morality of like global relations coming into question was really interesting.
And then,
yeah, I think that was their critique on capitalism too, you know, because like Adam Sandler says, he's like, look, I'm just, this is a loophole, whatever. I'm exploiting it, you know, like I'm giving him this much and I'm going to sell it for this much. Yeah. That's capitalism, baby. I'm a winner now. And he's just like, yeah, but you know, you're also kind of whatever, you know, Kevin Grant was like, Garnett was like, yeah, you're kind of fucking them over too. You're not giving them $1 million what it's worth. So I think that was their sly, you know, critique of the system.
And isn't something interesting about how they emphasize, they have this whole moment where they emphasize that the Ethiopians are black Jews. They're not just like workers. They're also related to a religious tradition and a cultural tradition and a history that has beliefs in the divine, and that there's something maybe mystical, maybe Kabbalistic even, or something about like Jewish mysticism that's related to this, that opens us up to the transcendent, that kind of creates a different way of viewing the world rather than just simply in terms of production. So is that an element that I think we should focus on, or is it just because of my previous study into religion that I focused on that?
I don't know.
They definitely just bring it up several times. I'm not Jewish, so I definitely think I wasn't getting some of the maybe inside baseball of that. But yeah, I don't know.
I mean, I will say in a much less esoteric and beautiful way than Austin was saying, it was cool to see the representation of American Judaism in the film, even from like the Passover scene, because I couldn't help but think, and as someone that regularly gets to participate as the token goyim in Passover meals, you know, think about how many films where we have a Thanksgiving meal or Christmas meal as a set piece. It was really cool to see that. And to have that be a centerpiece of it, and even to have the part where like, and obviously we don't know, you know, where Howard's character was in the birth order, but when talking about the plagues at the Passover Seder, you know, he brings up the death of the firstborn, and this sort of the ideas of plagues and death that are haunting people seem to connect then with him getting murked at the end.
Yeah, because he does say that like it can still happen, right? He's making a joke to his kids, but he's like, it can happen at any time. The death of the firstborn can happen. He's like, it can still happen, right? And he's making it as a joke to his kids, but maybe that's a foreshadowing of himself.
I don't know.
Didn't even pick up on that.
Neither did I, but yeah, that could be. Well,
before we don't got to start wrapping up yet, but before we do, there's one topic I wanted to make sure I asked y'all about. And we talked about the chaos of the film, but I was really struck by the way in which the speed of the film itself induced a sort of anxiety. I know it in myself throughout the film. And I know when I left, I was like hustling down the street. I had to stop myself because I realized I was power walking because I was so jacked up. And then I noticed this watching it a second time. I didn't have that feeling. I was almost able to like take a breath and just take it in. So, I mean, what do we think about how the pacing of this film produced an anxiety in the audience? Like, to me, that seemed pretty significant. And it was, I don't know how to articulate why it was important, but I found it really affecting.
I mean, isn't this in some ways maybe an unconscious, or I'm sure it's not unconscious because they're obviously master filmmakers, but there's like an almost unintended ethic, or I hesitate to use the word moral, but that a filmmaker projects through their formal and aesthetic product. So it's like they're, I don't know, are they intentionally trying to induce anxiety so that we feel the consequences of being a degenerate gambler, or the consequences of the contradictions of the capitalist system, or something like that? Like, are they intending
and we do
that?
Feel, yeah, there's a lack of reflection in all the decisions. Every decision gets made without any thought, any reflection. And that's why as the audience were like, oh shit, don't do that. Oh shit, don't do that. Because it's just going down this chaotic hill.
So it's like, that's what I mean. Is that like a warning from the Safdies? They're like, yeah, this is what happens so that you, the audience, feel it. I don't think it's like a moralism, but it's almost like that's a byproduct, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, what I was going to say was that I think first and foremost, they're trying to make just a badass movie that is very entertaining. Yeah. You know, that I think that when I said they're the real deal before, what I've been waiting for forever, my whole life, is people to, you know, make a very engaging, entertaining, crowd pleasing art movie that is, you know, fun to watch, but says a lot, you know, too, at the same time. And not many of those filmmakers exist, you know, even like the people I love, like Martin Scorsese, you know, makes, you know, very, epic films, but like they're not as gritty as like I want, as I like, you know. Sam Raimi is one of my favorite filmmakers, but you know, no one's doing what the Safdie brothers are doing right now. And they understand that, you know, they want to make movies that people want to actually go out and see, but also that are totally true to life and, you know, and to themselves. And I commend them for it. And, what was the thing that you were just saying, Mike, about anyway? Like for one, that the fact that they start the movie by going up his ass, okay, you know, like they're making these bold choices. Oh yeah, I remember it was about the tension.
Yeah,
you know, they're basically one of the most addicting things in film is your hero making obviously bad decisions. It's like so cringeworthy. You want to sit there and go, why you're yelling at the screen. It's like in horror movies a lot, you know, but you really see it in a thriller like this, where your hero, who's not that likable, but somehow you're rooting for, you know, is, yeah, they just get storytelling. Oh yeah. And then also the punch-ins on like the ringing doorbell and stuff, like that motif. You know how it's like they're constantly having to open the door, buzz people in, and they're showing those punch-ins and stuff. They use that as a tension device in their supernaturalistic aesthetic for the rest of the movie. It's just a really cool mix. And then you mix in that with the really natural, realistic actors, and you get this bizarre movie.
Yeah. And I would definitely say, if anyone has seen this once, and if you have the time, and this was recommended to me by our wisecrack comrade, Helen, watch it again, because it's so different once you know that he's going to catch that little metal piece of candy right in the noggin at the end. once that anxiety is alleviated, you kind of can step back, and he becomes more of like a tragic figure when you know where he's going. So, you know, when it hits streaming or whatever, watch it again. Before we head into mailbag stuff and voicemail stuff, any final thoughts on this one?
I mean, the only thing that I was thinking that I was, and I don't want to get too far into the weeds here, but I was thinking that there's really interest. I just, the title, I can't get out of my head, like Uncut Gems, right? Like it's not just about this black opal that is uncut, that is supposed to be worth a particular amount. But here's the interesting thing. It gets undervalued in its appraisal. Right. Mm-hmm. So it's almost like there's a sense in which there's a tension between what it is in its potency and how it's valued once it's incorporated or appropriated into the system. And I wonder if we can't think of it similarly, like with humans, that we have these drives that are universal, that are beautiful, that speak of the whole universe, that open us up to the infinite. But at the same time, you always have to be welcomed into the symbolic, right? You have to be welcomed into the world of desire. You can't just exist at the world of drive. And if you just become pure drive, your demise is ultimately going to lead to death. I'm sorry, your end is ultimately going to lead, or your, I guess what it leads to is your demise. And that's what ends up happening with Howard and Adam Sandler, is that he's just a figure of pure drive. That's why he's tragic, is that he can't fit himself into the world of the symbolic appropriately. It's not enough for him. And so he can't adjust appropriately, which is why he's degenerate and sick, ultimately, in the literal sense.
So awesome. Would you say that like Kevin Garnett and Adam Sandler, when they both look at the gym for the first time, you know, they both have, you know, like that Adam Sandler has that awesome moment where he just looks up and goes, I want to come or I'm going to come. You know, and then Kevin Garnett, you know, he's looking into it and he sees the universe and then he like smashes the thing and he's the glass. He's like, that's a sign. Now, it seems like in the movie they have like a similar reaction, but at the end of the day, Adam Sandler, I feel like, is looking at it and going, I'm going to make so much money off of this. You know, look at this amazing thing. And then Kevin Garnett is really being like, you know, he appreciates it for what it is. And he just happens to be rich enough to purchase it. I mean, do you take anything from that? Like, do you agree with that?
I think that Kevin Garnett is the foil because he's the one who can be embraced into or incorporated into the system of desire, into the symbolic order through the game that he plays, which is why at the end when he's being interviewed, it's a heroic celebration that he just engaged in what Adam Sandler believed was the same type of compulsive activity, that drive activity. But it's not. It's different. It's a game with rules that Garnett follows, and there's a goal to it, which is the end to win. And then, of course, to silence his doubters, because that's what Garnett is saying. Like, what, you didn't think I could fucking do this and that I wouldn't show up in Game 7? Of course I'm going to show up in Game 7. So there's, again, this relation to this external thing, like, you don't think I can do this, I can do it. And Sandler kind of thinks he has a similar goal, but he doesn't. He doesn't quite understand anything outside of himself, which is why he doesn't ever say I love you to Julia Fox's character until the very end when he wins. She keeps saying I love you to him and he doesn't ever say it back, which means that he's lying when he does say I love you, I think. I don't think he really does love her. She's just kind of another component in his larger compulsive tendency. You know?
Yeah, I think we see that in the moment where when his wife is trying on her bat mitzvah dress, he's like, I'm done with her. I want you back. Because, you know, I think we kind of see that he's just trying to find affirmation wherever he can get it on his way to the next big score.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, we all liked it. Everyone should watch it. And of course, we would love to hear what you think about it. So just as a reminder for everyone, you can hit us up via email at movies@wisecrack.co. No M, just co. Or give us a call at 213-534-8807. And along those lines, I guess we have some voicemails and mailbag stuff from the last one. So let's maybe start with a voicemail we have on Parasite. Sadly, I didn't get to be a part of it, but just listen to it. And you all had a hell of a discussion on another movie that was great. So let's listen to what our buddy Ethan had to say about Parasite.
Hey, this is Ethan. I just listened to the Parasite podcast, and I think it's just the best movie of the year. And I'm bummed that it's not nominated for a Golden Globe for Best Film. But anyways, I saw the whole movie three times, and there's one line that the dad says after the flooding of his house. He's lying on the ground and he says to his son, you know, whatever you do, none of it matters. You betray your country, you kill someone, like, it all doesn't matter. And, you know, there's that nice foreshadowing to him killing somebody at the end, but my real question is, do you think that foreshadows the son's inevitable failure at the end? You know, he says his son has this nice goal to go and make a lot of money so he can free his dad. Do you think his dad is foreshadowing saying, whatever you do, it doesn't matter? Or do you think that this dad, by committing murder, you know, where he's showing the audience that it, you know, kind of does matter that you kill someone, now his whole life has been destroyed. So I don't know. I just like your thoughts on that. Thanks.
Fellas,
what do you guys think? I don't have any immediate thoughts.
Yes, I agree. That was a good voicemail.
I don't know. I don't know if I have anything to add. I think that's just he was asking, like, do I think it's this or do I think it's that? I mean, it very well could be either, but I do like the idea that it's like there's almost a fatalism, right?
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't on the Parasite episode, so I'm sorry, Ethan. I might be speaking out of turn here. Plug your ears if you don't want to hear my dumb thoughts on this. I get it. But I do think that scene where they're in like the shelter or whatever, and the dad kind of says like it doesn't matter. I feel like at that point, too, is kind of making a commentary on them and their class position in society, almost saying like, hey, we're at the bottom of the dregs, man. We live in the alley where people piss out their soju, like, doesn't matter. No one cares about you. A sort of fatalism there. And I think you see that at the end, you know, at the end of Parasite, when we see, you know, his vision for, and I'm going to get a job and I'm going to make money and I'm going to free him. Like, we know he's not going to do that. We of course know it's never going to happen because sadly the way the cards are stacked against him, his desires maybe don't matter in society in that way. And I think that's why there's a sort of, I guess, fatalism that's just based on where you happen to fall in society and what your possibilities are. The same way that for one family in Parasite, rain means devastation. For another, it means, oh, our garden looks great.
Yeah, and you can play and you can put your tent out there and it's romantic and you can fuck. Because that's when they start banging and they get turned on. Yeah, exactly.
And you have a cool Native American party, which is totally appropriate. Everyone should do it. I think, Austin, you're in charge of the mailbag right now. I think you're the mailman, the Karl Malone, one could say.
That's right.
To reference basketball again. Yeah, so let's let's get into that mailbag, buddy.
All right, so we got one from Luis, who says, hey, Wisecrack, love everything you do. Please keep it up. We shall. I was thinking that the parasite might be the idea that living in a capitalist society induces upon us that we should make money to be emphasized. In the sense that this idea is not intrinsic to human being or human survival, and that once you put it there, it creates the distinction between those who have it, those who don't, and what are people willing to do to have it. And then it goes on, he says, like you discussed, with hustle mentality and the idea that you must step on somebody else to get where you want, I felt that putting a poor family through this struggle was to highlight that this is not something that rich people do because they are ruthless. This is something that sadly has to be done per the rules of this system. And this is so because capitalism infects us to behave in these ways. What do you think? I just want to say this. I'm actually really surprised at the adeptness of cultural criticism and like economic criticism that our audience have with their emails and their thoughts in this. And maybe it's, I don't know if the film is like inspiring people to study more or think more, but the stuff that we've been getting in relation to Parasite has been really insightful. So, but yeah, what do you think? Is the film talking about money makes you be like you become human or you are less than human or you are trapped.
I've learned we got a whole bunch of damn commies in our audience, man. That's what I've learned. Goddamn.
Oh no. It's Ryan's going on this whole McCarthy era thing. I apologize. He is classifying emails and will be doing an investigation. We apologize in advance.
Yeah. I wonder was anybody upset at Parasite? Like if you're like a really hardcore, like say you're a Wall Street bro and you watched Parasite, can you still enjoy the film or are you like, fuck
yeah,
you?
They love it. All these rich people, like, I mean, you got some shit online, you know, like Obama that, you know, is quite a wealthy cat. He liked it. Chrissy Teigen, who is very wealthy, was talking about she liked it. I think a lot of very rich people like it because I don't know. I mean, maybe you can like it because in the film, it's not like the Park family are evil. Like they're not bad. That's just their class position within society. And I think there's a way and I think that's the interesting thing about this film. I don't think it'd be doing so well and getting so much great coverage if it made people feel like alienated or shat upon.
Mm. I can answer this, Austin, because I love the fuck out of this movie and I am, you know,
a libertarian.
I'm on the other side of this, you know.
He's
so
rich.
But it's not because I'm just so like, oh, I believe in capitalism so much that that's my religion or whatever. It's like, I sort of bring it back to Uncut Gems. You know, I see the world and the universe and time and history, you know, as this chaotic thing that, you know, we've managed to somehow put into some order and make a couple good systems to, you know, that aren't perfect that, you know, you can figure out how to do well in. So like, I totally take every, criticism of capitalism, you know, seriously. And I love Parasite and what it's saying, you know, but also I believe that people can, you know, I believe that guy at the end can fucking work and do what he says, even though, yeah, like you said, it's unlikely, but it's like, it's possible, you know? And so I do believe it. I'm an optimistic person at the end of the day. So I do think that, you know, you can appreciate this movie if you're, you know, capitalist minded like I am.
Yeah.
I guess.
And just to quickly comment on that email before we go on to the next one, I do think there's an interesting idea there with like you need money to be, and there's like a gradation of existence and sort of how much you matter or exist in society. And what we see in the film is certain people that exist, that are present, that we see everywhere, and other people that almost exist in the shadows, on the cobblestone stairways, in the basements of things. So I think that's a really interesting point. And to second what you already said, Austin, Wisecrack listeners and viewers are the best.
Honestly, I'm
smart.
Literally baffled by emails that I get, DMs that I get, the questions that people ask.
I'm always impressed.
So I'm fucking impressed, man. It gives me hope. Like if there's so much shit going on in social media and we constantly bang our heads about how stupid the blue check marks can be sometimes, I have hope for human beings, especially the Zoomer generation, man. You guys are fucking
I love them so much.
As shit, man.
Someone wants to, they can go back to the culture binge where I just talked about Zoomers for half an hour and they had to like shut me up. Sorry, more emails.
Yeah, well, okay. So this one is from Cyprian. This is changing gears a little bit. First of all, I love the name Cyprian. That's beautiful. But this is about Irishmen. And it's about the issue of leaving the door open, which we talked a little bit about. So, hi, Wisecrack. I really enjoyed your discussion about this scene and particularly Austin's reading of it. That's why I chose this email. Thank you, Cyprian.
Wow.
Nonetheless, I have a simpler reading. That is, Frank is just afraid of death and he wants the door to be left open. Why might that be? Maybe because he's afraid to die alone or he wants to be heard in case he's about to die and needs help. Anyway, I believe this might be an act that people who know that they're going to die might soon do. My grandfather, who passed away, rest in peace, brother, used to ask me to leave the door open every time I was visiting him. He had a history of strokes, and the doctor told him that the next one might be fatal. Sorry if my email was too dark, but at Wisecrack, that's probably the standard. I'm a huge fan of your podcasts. Keep cracking wise, Cyprian.
I hate to say this, but sounds like your grandpa was a hitman, dude.
Oh, boy.
What?
It's probably the family's going through stuff and you're out here like, no, he killed people.
To be fair, that sounds like a joke that Michael would make on Twitter. So, I mean, this is with my voice, sweetheart.
All right. I'm sorry. I apologize.
No, that's a good reading. Also, you guys, great episode in The Irishman. I listened to it right after watching it. That's a good read.
I recently went through a big gnarly health scare, right? And the thing that was overwhelmingly present in my emotional state, in my thoughts, was that no matter what, you die alone. I can't remember if we talked about this on the Irishman podcast, but I was terrified of that. I was looking around me in a country that isn't the country where my family are and the majority of my really close friends are. And I remember thinking that I was alone, and you get scared that you don't have someone to just fucking hold your hand. And there was something beautiful about the elderly couple across from me that I really bonded with them and their kids. And, you know, the married couple had been together for like 40 years. And I think the gentleman has passed now, but there was something so amazing about seeing connection and family and not being alone in the midst of this terrifying ordeal where you are alone no matter what. And so there's this weird tension. And so I do wonder if there's something about leaving that door open, because it's like, you can't be alone. And even though he's isolated from his children at the end of the film and he only has them through his pictures, he can somehow not be alone. And then, of course, who's the people that are gazing in at him? It's us, the audience. So there's this weird like voyeurism almost. Yeah. I don't know.
Can I say the only thing y'all missed when talking about The Irishman is just that really it's a movie about snitching and how he was a goddamn snitch. The movie shouldn't have been made because he should have kept his damn mouth shut. Sorry. I care about these things.
Snitches end up in.
Yeah. Do we got anything else in your mailbag, Mail Santa?
Yeah. So I got one more that I'll do. So this is a meta question from Alexandra. So it says, hi, great people from Wisecrack. I'm recently become a patron. And
thank you.
Yeah, I've been expecting to get a raise this month. Hopefully this catch. I did it, so I'm a patron. Much love from Sao Paulo, Brazil. So thank you so much, Alexandra. So first of all, I'd like to thank the channel, inspiring me, all this other stuff. So thank you for all that. It's a long email, so I'm just going to jump to the question. Now to the important question. What the fuck has happened to society that we are enjoying more meta commentary on the shows we like, that we can't perceive the honestly and shameless parody of the world we live in and that they are portraying? And this is in all caps with a lot of question marks and exclamation points at the end.
Wow. That's a good question.
Wait, I'm not sure I understand the question.
Okay, so then Alexandra goes on and says, so just as some context to my question, we've got quite a handful of shows commenting on themselves, like Rick and Morty. Dan Harmon's been doing this since Community. South Park, they've done this since season one with Terrence and Phillip. BoJack Horseman, et cetera, et cetera. And don't get me started on those series that break the fourth wall that are getting a lot of attention. Fleabag, Parks and Rec, The Office, District 9, etc. So it seems like it's this, maybe we could call it the postmodern distancing, commenting on itself, irony type of thing, maybe, Michael, right?
Yeah. I mean, But my simple response to this wonderful question by this kind person, they should try to watch Joe Pera Talks With You on Adult Swim. It's the only honest show on television. No one's watching it. 12-minute episodes. A bunch of them are online for free. But I think there is something there. Like, it's become – well, I mean, why do we not have shows that are like that? Well, because a lot of that necessitates art that is kind of vulnerable, or maybe risks trying to say something real about humans. But, like, that's not cool anymore. That's not what we're into. And even, I don't know, like, I love Succession. I think it was one of the best shows of the year, but it's still just like this removed thing. Cause as the audience, we're kind of like, yeah, these people are shitty though. We're just not getting a lot of art that risks trying to say something earnest about humans.
Don't you think that Scorsese, though, to tie this into The Irishman, that he is precisely a moralist? Like, he is trying to say stuff constantly, which is part of the reason why his films, like Silence, is a very interesting meditation on religion and the divine. You know, Wolf of Wall Street is clearly trying to say something about humans. The Irishman is clearly trying to say something about death and the end of your life. And again, the divine. Scorsese's a Catholic. So he's like a moralist for sure, right?
Yeah. Well, and I think there's a reason why a lot of the examples that I think that they had in there were TV shows. I think TV has gone so meta. To the point it's becoming like self-parody. So I don't know. I don't have like a good answer, but I viscerally agree with the sentiment, and I get really excited when I watch things these days.
Well, let me ask you this, Michael, real quick. And I don't mean to cut you off, Ryan, if you were going to jump in there, but so do you think that this is a symptom of a larger cultural tendency? Like, you wrote the video that we did on, Bo Burnham, and that there's something about like culture and the expression of culture as responding to other socioeconomic, like, is there something about the way that these films are reflections of these other anxieties, like that we can't be honest because not only is honesty not cool, but like honesty will get you killed, or honesty will, like, it gets snuffed out, or you can't be like what, like it's just impotent, like what is it?
And this is where I give a really good answer that's both insightful, references text and other things. We're going to punch it in later. So I'm just going to talk right here. No, I wish I had a profound response to that. And I think that logic does get at something, but I don't know what it is. And the best thing I can think about is a society where a lot of young people especially are anxious and they're on guard and they're not sure if they're going to be able to pay for college or if they're going to get that job or what's going to happen next. And I feel like when we're in an anxious place and we're kind of scared, we get protective, and we're protective, we're not into like vulnerability. And I think that might affect the art that gets made. But that's the best I got for that.
I have a much simpler answer.
Yes.
And I just think it's a natural evolution, for one, of postmodern. For one, it's just fun to play with the form and aesthetic of anything, you know, like just as a filmmaker in general. So and I think that basically when the screenwriters are sitting down to write their next thing, they're going to go, all right, we've already had The Office. You know, it's this super meta postmodern show. We've already had this. Top that. Let's comment on the show itself again. You know, it's like double commenting, double postmodern. Everyone's trying to out modern themselves and out irony themselves. And it is fun. It's intoxicating. I like it. It's entertaining. You know, I don't get sick of that form usually, but it is at the end of the day, you know, you don't have the feels, man. I miss feeling and true emotion and non-ironic, just, you know, like actual stories where you're not you don't have to be commenting on some either, you know, societal thing or the show itself. I don't know. What do you guys think?
Yeah.
Well,
there's something to this, because I think what we're getting at is like, what is the cause of this, right? Like, is there an underlying anxiety that is taking place at the material level that is then producing these effects? Or there's a lot of people, there's an art critic named John David Ebert who talks about how artists are always the first ones. They're actually ahead of time. Now, whether or not I buy this, there's something interesting in this. Like, and I think this fits into what you're saying, is like the artists are kind of like, no, we've been doing this form for a while and it's still, let's just try something new. Let's play with the form. Let's just kind of do something different. And that then produces other changes at that kind of other material level. So it's that ideas drive things. And there does seem to be something that, like, when Tarantino is like, laterally referring to this film and this film and that other film and this other film. And then he creates this like pastiche piece that there's something novel about it. But then it's like, so then what's next? Like, we can't just keep watching Tarantino films forever and ever. So then you get something like Uncut Gems, or you get something that is very sincere, like Little Women, you know, that those films, they aren't doing that kind of lateral pastiche and they're doing something different. So it's like, what does the artist do to just try to do something that excites them? And does that drive things?
I don't know what the artist does, to be honest, but I know what we have to do.
Aww.
We have to sadly pull this train into the station. And speaking of feelings, I feel like we've had a fun time. I feel like we've learned. Yeah. I feel like we've dived in to a great movie. We got great questions. And once again, keep calling. Keep emailing at movies@wisecrack.co. Come back to this podcast. Come back to our other stuff. This has been so much fun.
I also want to add, I like Julia Fox a lot, is all I wanted to say. And I do think she's a true artist.
So for me, Michael, and Austin.
Yes, and hello.
Hi, goodbye. And Ryan.
Yeah.
This has been Show Me the Meaning.
Goodbye from Hollywood, California.